We're talking to Joel Greenberg. He is the author of A Feathered River Across the Sky, The Passenger Pigeon's Flight to Extinction. And that was published by Bloomsbury and came out in this last January. Greenberg is an author and a naturalist who's based in Chicago with a lifelong interest in birds. And so to begin talking about the passenger pigeon, this year, 2014, is a special anniversary in the history of the passenger pigeon. Maybe you could explain why.
Sure. Passenger pigeon was certainly the most abundant bird in North America. As late as 1860 or so, there were probably billions of them. And in 1914, just, 50-some years later, the last of the species, a bird named Martha, died in the Cincinnati Zoo. And so it's significant because it's unusual when you know with precision when the last of a species died. And second, the depletion of such abundance in such a short period of time provides many lessons for us today living in the 21st century. It's a cautionary tale to the proposition that no matter how abundant something is, be it fuel, water, or something alive, if we're not good stewards, we can lose it.
Right. The story almost reminds me in some ways of the story of what happened to the Titanic. There was this idea that it just couldn't sink, but it wasn't true. It reminds me of that.
Yeah, I mean, I could see that now. You know, in the case of the pigeon, you know, some people surely knew it was declining, although it may have been too late at that point. But there was an active attempt by the industry. The pigeons were a product in a game market industry, which deliberately tried to kind of deny that the bird was even getting scarce. So I don't know. Maybe there are analogies, analogs that happened on the Titanic as well.
Right. I'd like to come back a little later to some of those denials that were happening when the bird began to become scarce. But first, let's talk a little bit more about the pigeon, since it's been 100 years since anybody was able to see one. What were they like?
Well, they looked a lot like mourning doves. I call them in the book like mourning doves on steroids. They're about 1.5 times the size. The males had red breasts and blue-gray backs. The females were somewhat beige underneath. Probably the thing, though, that marked them most in appearance is when they aggregated in huge concentrations. Now, the birds nested by the pairs here or 10 there, 100 there, but they're best known for these breeding and roosting areas where hundreds of millions of birds would gather. And so in migration, they would form huge flights. And so, for example, John James Audubon, in traveling along the Ohio River from his home in Henderson, Kentucky, to Louisville, over the course of this 3-day trip, he said the sky, the sun was eclipsed by flights of pigeons for the entire duration of the 3 days. And there are many accounts over all of the major cities of the United States and Canada within pigeon range of the skies being black for hours at a time. So it was probably that spectacle, that sheer manifestation of abundance that probably, you know, makes the bird most unusual.
And this was a bird that was native to the United States.
Correct. It was found in the, basically the east, most of them lived in the eastern third of the United States and Canada. So it's really as much about Canada as the U.S., but those two countries.
Right, so native to North America, I guess, would be a
right,
better...
Right, except that they didn't live in Mexico, so...
Okay. Okay. So the sort of the more northern US and Canada is where you would find passenger pigeons most of the time.
Well, I mean, I would say that from the southern shores of Hudson Bay on the north to the Gulf States on the south, from the Atlantic on the east to the Great Plains on the west.
Okay. How did it get its name? Its English
Okay.
name, I should say.
Yeah, they're not messenger pigeons. They're not carrier pigeons. Those are names used for the semi-domestic European rock pigeon. Passenger pigeons moved across the landscape largely looking for food, and so they were here today, gone tomorrow. They were birds of passage. So really, their movements were less like, say, warblers, which go north in the spring and south in the fall, as much as like cedar waxwings or red crossbills, birds that move around kind of irregularly, but in search of food.
So it got the name passenger because they would pass through and.
Exactly. They were called the nomads of the bird world, gypsies of the bird world. So they were always moving, and there were times where they, one winter, one December, they were seen on the southern shores of James Bay in Canada. One year they nested in the spring in Mississippi. So they would show up kind of wherever the food was.
What did they like to eat?
Well, they ate lots of things. They're known to have eaten 41 genera of plants, but overwhelmingly they preferred the nuts of oak and beech, particularly during the breeding season. And I think the reason is that those nuts were very nutritious, and those nutrients helped contribute to reproductive success.
You mentioned that they would form huge flocks, and you write in the book that when they would settle on a landscape, they could transform it.
Absolutely. And that's those are the kinds of things that are almost amazing. Even though these birds, little maybe 10 ounces in weight, enough of them would land in big oaks, say, and where the branches would break, and there were accounts of trees almost tipping over under the weight of these birds. There's an account from Berrien County, Michigan, not all that far to the south west of where you are, a guy writing that the people were so afraid that their forests would be ruined that they were out there. He could hear them. They were shooting the birds all night, and he said he was weary as he had tried to do that for his own forest. So they were a force, and it's not so much that they were destructive as much as like fire. Fire's neither good nor bad. They landed in these big trees, and their droppings would accumulate. Later on, when the birds were gone, some of that land became known as the most fertile farmland in the region. By breaking the canopy, by breaking these branches and creating tinder, they probably contributed to fires. And fires, promote oak, say, thick barked oak over, say, maple. So they had an impact on the ecosystems of which they were a part. And that would have been one way.
And you write that at the time that Europeans arrived in the United States, they might have formed as much as 20 to 40% of the total bird population.
Yeah, that's based on an idea, sort of an estimate that there were maybe 3 to 5 billion passenger pigeons, and then you take an estimate of the total amount of birds that have been made, and so you compare the 3 to 5 billion with the total number, and so you come up with something like 20 to 40%. The birds were never studied in life, and so what I just said about their impact on the ecosystem, or trying to come up with a number for them, that's somewhat conjecture. We don't know these things with precision. We know there were vast numbers, and they surely, had an impact on the world in which they inhabited, just as their loss in a short time undoubtedly had an impact as well.
Right. You write about the interactions between pigeons and people going back, obviously, long before Europeans came to North America. It seems as though at various times people saw them as a blessing or a curse, depending on what the pigeons were doing or when they arrived. Maybe you could talk about that.
Sure. So you know, the first European settlements were, you know, in New England and Eastern Canada. And so one person complained. He said one year, you know, the pigeons came and ate their crops, and the pigeons were a nuisance. And then the next year they had a crop failure. And right after they determined that food would be really scarce, the pigeons arrived and they shot the pigeons and ate them. So sometimes they were helpful to the settlers, and sometimes they were less helpful.
Right. It's interesting to read the different accounts of the pigeons, as you were mentioning, saving people from famine by arriving at the right moment. A bit of a trade-off, I guess, for also appearing sometimes and eating your crops.
Exactly. Both, you know, two sides of a sword, as it were, you know, there's just depending on circumstance. They certainly had an impact in some places on agriculture. It seems that when they had access to natural food, they kind of ignored fields. But another aspect of that is because of their depredations on crops, it actually created an agricultural innovation. Farmers used to throw seeds on the top of the soil, and in those situations, sometimes the pigeons would arrive and, you know, eat up all the seeds the farmer had just thrown out. But a guy in Wisconsin near Horicon, he developed a cedar where the seeds were placed under the ground. And so as a consequence, the pigeons were thwarted, and he created that deliberately, you know, to help farmers if there were pigeons around. So there's another instance where the pigeons ultimately had a positive effect.
People ate them. Were they tasty?
They were, and varying, you know, different people had different opinions of them. Alexander Wilson, grandfather of American ornithology, said that when pigeons are served for breakfast, lunch, and dinner for weeks at a time, then you really get sick of even the name. But some people like them. Their popularity really came down to they were cheap. I mean, they were the cheapest terrestrial protein. They could be sold for pennies apiece. But at the same time that, you know, servants and poor were eating them, they appeared on the menu of Delmonico's in New York City, arguably America's first great restaurant. It was served at some of the great banquets of the 19th century. So, you know, the gourmets used them, and the poor used them to stave off starvation. So they were used by everybody.
And aside from food, it sounds like people hunted them for sport, but for other reasons as well, for feathers, for fat.
Correct. Mostly, I mean, like the issue of with feathers. Feathers were more an added benefit to the killing of them for food. But pigeon feathers did have value. It was thought there was kind of a legend that if you slept on a bed stuffed with passenger pigeon feathers, you would never die. And so, you know, there was some popularity in that. In the earlier days, I mean, there are several accounts of Native Americans who would fill, you know, barrels with pigeon fat and use it, you know, in place of butter, say. So I don't know that the use of their fat was widely used once the, you know, whites sort of became the dominant force, but it was certainly used by some Native American groups.
I see. Now, Native Americans and then Europeans hunted the pigeons for hundreds of years, and yet it seems from what you write as though something changed in the mid-19th century and began to accelerate the decline of the pigeon. Maybe you could break down what happened then.
Sure. So one of the aspects of the pigeon, because they were moving around for food, they would often be absent from an area for years at a time. And so because they were constantly moving, people hunted them, but they weren't really, it wasn't possible to chase them until in the 1840s, the introduction and expansion of two technologies, the railroad and the telegraph. So the railroad meant that wherever the birds showed up, I mean, in the Upper Peninsula, in the Ozarks of Missouri, even if it was in an out-of-the-way place, if you could take the dead birds that you've killed, that you've hunted, to a rail station, you put them in barrels, 300 birds to a barrel, pack it with ice, and then you could send it out to the urban markets of the Midwest and East. The telegraph meant that the whereabouts of the birds could be monitored throughout the year. In fact, telegraph operators were specifically instructed to send that information out so it could be sent out quickly and widely. And so there developed a group of hunters, anywhere from maybe 600 to 3,000, we're not sure, who did nothing but spend the entire year chasing the pigeons and killing them unceasingly throughout the seasons. And so those technologies, which facilitated communication and transportation, really started the birds into their spiral to extinction.
So the railroad and the telegraph made it possible to locate the birds and then transport the dead birds where they could be sold. You say that people deployed just about every means possible to slaughter pigeons.
Some of the goofier ones, potato farmers in Ontario, if they were harvesting their crop and the birds were flying low overhead, they throw potatoes at the birds. And it's good to read that they lost more potatoes than killed passenger pigeons. But every so often, they'd knock a pigeon out of the sky and most of the stew would fall at their feet. But the two methods that were the greatest force of mortality on the birds was shooting and netting. Somebody described shooting passenger pigeons was something beyond that could not be resisted. And so they were shot, for fun. They were shot for food. A flight of pigeons over a fort on the northern shores of Lake Ontario in the 1840s, bored soldiers saw the flocks fill their cannon with grape shot and fired into the flocks and, watch the dead birds floating on the river, on the lake. Netting was probably the backbone of the industry because netting is cheaper than shooting. Shooting, you have to buy ammunition and powder. So with the netting, they would use live birds as decoys, stool pigeons, and they would set up the stool pigeons would be used to attract the birds, and then they could release the netting from blinds where the hunters were hiding, and they could catch hundreds, sometimes 1,200 or 1,300 in a single release of the net. And so those two techniques is really what resulted in most of the birds being captured.
Right. Is it possible to narrow it down to just a handful of years that had the greatest effect?
Yeah, I mean, if you consider that in 1871, the largest nesting on record took place in central Wisconsin. This nesting spread across 850 square miles near the Dells, Wisconsin Dells, and probably involved over 136 million birds. Okay, that's 1871. 1878, just 7 years later, the last large nesting occurred in Petoskey, Michigan, at the northern end of the Southern Peninsula. That nesting took place over about 200 square miles and maybe involved 50 or 60 million birds. And then just 4 years after that, in 1882, the biggest nestings were about, you know, a million or two birds, and that happened in a few places in Wisconsin and one in Pennsylvania. So in that period of, you know, 1870 or so to 1882, the birds went from, you know, hundreds of million or more to just a very small number.
And what happened when people started noticing, as they must have, that there weren't as many pigeons around?
Yeah, you might have hoped that they would have said, gee, you know, let's be a little more circumspect in our use of them. Let's kill fewer. But the impression that I get from reading the literature is that may have been the sentiments of a few. But most of the hunters took the different tact, and that is, this is running out. You know, we make our living doing this. We make money doing this. So we're going to kill every last bird we can. We're going to get every last penny we can out of this. So one example of that was in 1882, that I mentioned was really the last time there was a serious attempt to nest in any numbers. The squabs, the baby pigeons, were always the most coveted. They were tender and fat. But what they would usually do is after the birds hatched, they would wait a couple weeks for the birds to, you know, fill out to get some meat on them. But in 1882, as soon as the birds were hatched, and, you know, baby birds are bones and feathers, they would grab them and literally stomp them with their feet into barrels. And so, you know, it was like, we're not going to wait a moment longer than we have to. This is going to end anyway. Let's just take as much as we can while there's still something to take.
Were there attempts made to save the passenger pigeon, and when did they start?
Well, there never was an organized attempt. I include in the book the handful of accounts I know of where individuals expressed some affection for the bird and concern for their killing. Interestingly, and passenger pigeons were kind of dealt with separately. So in the 1850s, some states started passing laws to protect songbirds, and Ontario specifically excluded the passenger pigeon from its songbird protection law. Ohio in 1857 passed a small bird protection law and decided, well, what do we do about passenger pigeons? So a special committee of the state Senate was established. They deliberated, and they concluded that the pigeons were so common, their numbers could never be reduced. Michigan, you'll be happy to know, it was the only state or province ever to ban all killing of passenger pigeons. That happened in 1897. That's the good news. Bad news is, by then, there weren't any birds left. But, you know, there were some things that happened in Michigan in the 1878 nesting. I mentioned there were some people from Saginaw who went out to Petoskey and tried to get the few weak laws to be enforced. So, you know, that was an example. It started a national conversation on the pigeons, and, you know, it was probably a bit too late, though, and really didn't result in any effective conservation measures.
When was the last wild bird captured?
Yeah, the for a long time, it was thought that a bird shot in Ohio in 1900 was the last bird, but through my research, I found and documented two later birds. So one bird was shot near Springfield, Illinois in 1901, and the last bird shot, for which there's no doubt, was shot in Laurel, Indiana, which is sort of southern Indiana, in 1902. So the point really is that the last of the wild birds were gone by the first few years of the 20th century. And then you had three captive flocks, Martha in Cincinnati being part of one, and that was the last of the species. So when she died on September 1st, 1914, the passenger pigeon ceased being a living entity.
And that will be 100 years ago this September. When did it become apparent to people in general that the birds were gone?
Well, and that's kind of, you know, by people used to, you know, could remember when they would go out, they'd, you know, be able to fill a wagon with pigeons, or there'd be hours of a day in the spring or fall when there'd be huge clouds overhead. And so really, you know, probably by the 1880s, 1890s, they were considering the loss. And what's interesting is a lot of people denied that the birds had disappeared. And some of that was perpetuated by this industry, which was kind of making up stories about the birds. And so there were stories that the birds had moved to Arizona or Washington State. In fact, some said they even moved down to Colombia in South America and changed their appearance so no one would find them. And then there were those like Henry Ford who said, yes, the birds are gone. Henry Ford thought that the birds all drowned in the Pacific Ocean as they were flying to freedom. So people, you know, confronted with an inconvenient truth, were kind of making up stuff. And, you know, but even, in fact, there was a guy named Martin who was a pigeon dealer in Chicago, but he was defending the killing up until the end. And then he eventually wrote a paper, an article, after the birds were gone, and he was discussing that the birds are gone, and he said, I have no idea where they went or why they disappeared. So people, even at the end, some of them just wouldn't accept it. One thing, and you may be asking, but I want to make sure that we get this in, and that is the loss of the bird and the loss of other species of American wildlife helped spawn the country's first great environmental movement. So its loss was really not in vain. There were laws like the Lacey Act and the Migratory Bird Act, which are still in effect and still really anchor how this country manages its biological resources. And so, you know, that bird did clearly have a legacy, a strong conservation legacy.
In which case, it sounds like there must be a point when the denial, at least for some people, ended and there was a reckoning?
Well, you know, those who were denying that the birds were gone clearly had to hoist the white flag. But in terms of ever coming to grips with why they disappeared, I'm not sure everyone did that. I mean, clearly, you know, the scientists, and that was, you know, there was a growing number by the beginning of the 20th century. There were organizations, the Audubon Societies, the American Ornithologists Union. I mean, they had put up an alarm, you know, before the birds were probably gone in the, you know, late 1880s, but probably when it was too late. And, you know, I think the reckoning would have been the passage of these laws, so that we no longer in this country slaughter birds like that. I mean, there's other things we do that, you know, damage biodiversity. And that, in fact, some of those things led to the country's second great environmental movement of the 60s and 70s, Silent Spring, talking about how pesticides hurt birds and there's habitat loss and other kinds of pollution. And that led to laws, too, like the Clean Water Act and the Clean Air Act and the Endangered Species Act. So the Endangered Species Act was really a pledge that this country made that we would not allow species to become extinct, or at least not without trying hard to save them. And, you know, the law is currently under attack. And, you know, I'd love it if your listeners, those who care, you know, about preserving nature, would write their lawmakers, let them know that the Endangered Species Act is really important.
Right. Just looking over my questions here.
I can give you... there's a bird that lives in Michigan and virtually nowhere else in the world, and that's the Kirtland's warbler. That's in near Mayo and Grayling in the northern part of the southern peninsula. And that bird is really, it has a small range. It has really finicky habitat. We have figured out how to keep the numbers high. It requires making sure that the trees they like are of a certain height. It requires removing cowbirds, brown-headed cowbirds, which parasitate the warblers, and that costs $1 million a year. But if we spend $1 million a year, we can maintain Kirtland's warblers, the numbers. If we decide some point it's not worth it, then the Kirtland will probably become extinct.
And all of this ties back into the legacy of the extinction of the pigeons, in that it must have made people realize, as you said, that even a bird so abundant with enough concentrated slaughter could disappear.
Yeah, I mean, clearly it did. And I mean, one of the things that it's lost light to, I mean, here's a migratory bird, so it's moving around across states, indeed, across countries. And so, you know, that's why the Lacey Act, introduced into Congress in 1900, was the first time the federal government assumed jurisdiction over migratory birds. And then later, we signed a treaty with Britain, the Migratory Bird Treaty Act, to regulate the taking, you know, to protect birds migrating from Canada to the United States and back. And we've signed similar treaties with Russia, with Mexico, other countries whose avifauna we share.
Right. Was there any other extinction on the scale of the passenger pigeon in North America?
The closest, and I don't know it intimately, involved the Rocky Mountain locust. So this was a grasshopper type animal, and it too, there were billions and billions of them. They were an agricultural pest. There were efforts to control it, and in a pretty short period, they became extinct. I mean, there obviously were differences. I don't think, you know, the story is as well known. I mean, I think there's still questions about it. You know, grasshoppers never really, I think, drew as much attention as birds. But there was a case of this really abundant species that was a nuisance, and we wiped it out.
Maybe you could sum up what it is. What would you like people to take away from your book and the other projects you're working on related to passenger pigeons? What can the story of the passenger pigeon tell us now?
Sure. I mean, the story. So, you know, I'd like people to be familiar with the story. It's a lot of people have never heard of it. And then, you know, I think one message could be phrased like this, that, you know, if something as abundant as a passenger pigeon could disappear over 4 or 5 decades, things scarcer than that could disappear, you know, in the snap of a finger. That there's 7 billion human beings on the planet, over 300 million in the U.S., that we really need to proceed with caution. We need to be good stewards if the beauty of nature is to be sustained.
Talk a little bit about, beyond the book, some other projects, Project Passenger Pigeon, and also a documentary that you're helping to make happen.
Sure. That's so Project Passenger Pigeon came to be in February of 2011. And there are a number of elements to it, the book. We've been talking about that. Probably the single thing that can reach the most people is a documentary I'm making with David Mrazek, an award-winning director. It's called From Billions to None, The Passenger Pigeon's Flight to Extinction. And we talk about the pigeon. We talk about success stories. I mean, it's an upbeat, you know, movie talking about this bad event, and yet talking about, you know, how the future, depending on what we do, could for a lot of species be much, much brighter. The movie should be done at the end of this month, and our goal is to get it on as many public television stations as possible. And I would encourage your listeners to go to our website called From Billions to None, and we can still use some help in getting it aired widely. And so, you know, they might find that one thing we've done that I think is particularly cool. You know, you read these descriptions of, you know, millions of birds overhead darkening the skies, and so we've presented animated animated birds in big flocks based on actual specimens, so that they're quite realistic looking, and it gives you a visual sense of what you know. Otherwise, we could always only read in words.
And lastly, go ahead.
I was just going to say, there's also, you know, a variety of art exhibits. There's a variety of University of Michigan Museum of Natural History has created these really cool panels that are on our website. And if you're a museum or a nature center, you can download the panel and create your own passenger pigeon exhibit. There's a really cool thing in Cincinnati, in downtown Cincinnati at 9th Street and Vine. There's this big building with a passenger pigeon mural that was just completed last summer that's quite beautiful. Michigan is really doing a lot. Michigan is one of the maybe five or six states that have the strongest connection to the passenger pigeon's history. The first book ever written about the passenger pigeon was written in 1907 by a guy named William Butts Mershon, who was a former mayor of Saginaw. You know, the big nestings that I mentioned, a lot of those were in Michigan. And there's a lot of folks on Michigan State University, their museum is making a traveling exhibit. And so, really, there's a lot, your listeners, there's a lot, you know, a lot going on in Michigan. It's one of the most active states in marking this anniversary.
When I was finished reading the book, I couldn't help but feel a little, discouraged maybe, or a bit disgusted with people and they're having driven the pigeon to extinction. And yet, as we're talking, you're saying that it some good did come of this. People did learn. It sounds like, I guess it's not surprising, you would hope that people would take a message about what we can do now away from this, rather than just saying we killed all the passenger pigeons and they're never coming back.
Yeah, and you know, there are, I mean, I can give you, to mention the Kirtland's warbler, another bird that lives throughout Michigan is the sandhill crane. And we may take it, people shouldn't take it for granted that bird now is in big numbers, because, you know, in the 1930s, that bird was also on a trajectory, if not total extinction. It was almost gone from the Midwest. And, you know, we stopped shooting them, the numbers have built up. And so here in Chicago, for about a week in spring and about a week in fall, there's thousands of birds flying over. You can hear them with that wonderful trumpeting sound. So, you know, that's a clear success. The trumpeter swan, which at one time was reduced to a few birds in the Rocky Mountains in Alaska and Western Canada, has been introduced into places. And so they're now part of Michigan's avifauna as well. One final example is whales. I mean, the big whales, the blues and the rights. I mean, they were on their way to extinction, but the world agreed that wasn't a good thing, and they agreed not to kill them. And so those populations have increased. So, you know, there are examples of success stories, and you know, I think it's important to know about things like the passenger pigeon as kind of an inspiration of a sense to move in another direction and look at the success stories and know that better outcomes are possible.
Okay. Is there anything that you would like to add before we wrap up?
You've done a great job in covering a lot of the ground. Let's see. I talked. You know, I'm going to be in Kalamazoo, and then later in the year, I'm going to be in Ann Arbor and in Midland.
That's right.
And so,
you're presenting here on the 28th of April.
Correct, at the Kalamazoo Audubon Society, and look forward. Hope that people are interested in the story. They come. There actually will even be a passenger pigeon there, so they can hear a talk and see an actual passenger pigeon. There are more passenger pigeons in museums than that of any other extinct bird. There are probably anywhere from 1,500 to 2,000 of them, and Michigan has quite a few.
Those are stuffed birds.
Yeah, exactly.
Actually, there's a picture of you with a stuffed passenger pigeon. What was its name?
Yeah, Heinrich. America's first symphony composer was a man named Anthony Philip Heinrich, who wrote a 9-movement symphony about the pigeon. And so I bought this bird, and the bird from New Hampshire. And they're still going on eBay. I mean, every year there are two or three birds go up for sale, and prices vary. And I was able to get this bird for a low price. And I had my own passenger pigeon. It's not something I would have ever dreamt of ever having that opportunity.
All right. Well, Joel Greenberg, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you so much for having me.